Welcome to the 39th episode of Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, joined today by producer Rashad Asir, as well as, I guess what you're going to hear on this episode, at least on the back half, is a conversation I had earlier this week with Jason Calacanis. And so, yeah, fun conversation. Jason and I have been going back and forth on this for a while. So trust people will enjoy that. We talk about a bunch of different things, including his relationship with Palmer Luckey, how All In came to be, a bunch of other interesting stuff. Jason is nothing if not a someone that people have opinions about, and he certainly himself in the public square.
Had you guys met before?
No. He invited me on This Week in Startups in the middle of the pandemic, and I actually said no. We were kind of in the middle of fundraising, as well as I actually didn't know really who he was, and it was pre All In, and all I saw was him like sort of at times causing just a shitstorm on social media, like going back and forth with Taylor Ruins, and it just seemed very messy in a bunch of different ways. And so I was fairly new at Redpoint and was like, hey, I don't want to get involved in all that. And then since then, obviously, I've gotten to know him a little bit. We've gone back and forth on podcasts and things like that. And he's been supportive of what we're doing here pretty publicly at times. And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we have any relationship at all, other than we send messages back and forth occasionally about stuff.
Makes sense. I hadn't realized how long he's been covering tech for. And like, he's like an OG media guy.
It's wild. It's like, actually, I mean, he talks about it, but he was on the cover of New York Times like in 94 or something, right? So he's very used to being in the public eye, and I think really enjoys it, versus the other people within All In. I think it's a little bit new to them. And so he likes this like pseudo celebrity thing for sure.
Yeah. That's awesome. What else happened? So I guess the big things that happened this week are, well, Kanye's just been all over my seed.
Yeah.
Any take there?
How much have you been keeping up with all that stuff? Jason and I actually talk about it a little bit.
Why he like deletes all of his Instagrams periodically and then like posts a bunch of stuff. So I think I've seen the most recent version of whatever's on his Instagram feed.
I think, I mean, just to give people a quick context, I assume most people are following this, but like 2 weeks ago, he wore a White Lives Matter shirt to a Paris Week fashion show. He went on Tucker Carlson and made comments about Lizzo's weight. He discussed wearing a White Lives Matter shirt. Adidas said that they were going to review their relationship. Then he got locked out of Instagram, and was posting a bunch of anti-Semitic things on Instagram. Then he made the decision to buy Parler, which is a right-wing friendly social network. He went on Piers Morgan and said, there's nobody that gets judged more than straight white men. Balenciaga decided to cut ties with him. Ultimately, Adidas decided to cut ties with him. Kim Kardashian had to come out and make a statement about all of the anti-Semitic comments. Then Adidas ultimately publicly came out and cut ties as well. He went on Lex Fridman's podcast and talked about some of this stuff as well. But it's sad. The whole thing is like super sad. Yeah. Obviously what he's saying is deplorable, right? Someone with that platform saying the things he's saying is troubling, because he can reach a lot of people, and even small numbers of people that he can influence, right, can have catastrophic implications with it.
I saw that poster that folks were holding up on the bridge or something that was like, we support what Kanye says about White Lives Matter. I don't know if Justin, you can pull it up, but like, yeah, obviously, yeah, troubling.
Yeah. And then, so the anti-Semitism is just like, I mean, it's deplorable. It's disgusting. Like, it doesn't have any place in the world. It's, and then it's also, and so everything that's happening, I think he deserves, like all the sponsorship cuts and all of that. And so I think he's getting what's coming to him in that regard. But then it's also sad to see someone that clearly has mental health issues, right? And has been open about being bipolar and manic, I think, as well. Just clearly going through, I don't want to speculate overly, I certainly am not qualified for this, but someone that's clearly going through something, right? And with a history of mental health issues. And so that's a shame. And then it's a bummer people are giving him a platform to talk about all these things, right? It sort of feels inappropriate. And then at a personal level, like I'm just, he was one of the people I grew up, like he probably the concert, I've probably been to more Kanye West concerts than any other artist, right? Yeah. And I have more like pop art and just random, like, you know, tickets from concerts. And so in some ways, it's almost like I'm almost mourning the loss of like, it's been happening over time, right? Like some of the MAGA stuff and, you know, this has been trending in some direction for a little while now, but it feels like this is like the biggest culmination of it all. And so it's almost like someone that you don't, that you looked up to is dying or has died, right? It's like the character of this person that I've been following since I was like in middle school, right? Is no longer the person I thought it was. And I remember going to the Watch the Throne tour. I think I went to 3 shows. My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, I went to 3 shows. Yeezus, I went to 3 shows. Life of Pablo, I went to 3 shows. Graduation, I went to 2. So like all these different tours, I went to so many shows. And it was one of those things, I think at Life of Pablo, I remember going to the show and being like, gosh, this is such a moment in time where I'm seeing greatness. Maybe it was My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, but I'm seeing like greatness in a moment, and I should appreciate this. But then he just kept producing more and more content. And so it seemed like he was just going to keep going, right? And then you sort of have to appreciate these people when they're at the peak of their powers and doing what they're doing.
Yeah, his music took a weird turn at some point. The Poop Diddy Scoop release, whatever that was.
Yeah, you could see it kind of go like, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is one of my all-time favorites. And then Yeezus, I think, might be the best of his albums. After that, you know, Life of Pablo was very, very good, probably not quite at that level. And then he came out with, what was it, Yay, or the one that it was in front of the mountain that he filmed in Jackson Hole or whatever it was. And like, that was not very good, but there was still a handful of songs that you're like, oh, okay, I see this. And then just totally after that, it was like, all right, this is gone. Right. So I don't know. It's just sad. It's terrible. It's sad.
It's totally sad.
All that stuff.
I never followed him that closely, but I remember we were at a bar in the East Village the other day, and you forget sometimes how many bangers he's got. Like the DJ was playing Kanye songs for, I think, like 15 consecutive minutes, maybe 20 minutes, like back to back to back, little 1 minute snippets. And the whole place was just going crazy the whole time. Everyone's rapping the lyrics like to the word. He's a special artist.
Yeah. And so I hope he gets the help he needs. I've certainly appreciated as someone that, you know, has had people in their family with different levels of mental illness, have had different bouts of depression myself over time. Like I certainly appreciated him being public about all this, stuff. But now it sort of feels like we're at the point of him just needing help, right? Him just needing to like, and hopefully he has a group of people around him that can like rein him in a little bit, or whenever this manic episode or whatever it is passes by, hopefully he'll get the treatment and support and medication and all that stuff that he needs.
So I guess in other news, we've covered Elon and the Twitter story quite a bit on this podcast. That seems like it's coming to a conclusion, although every time we think it is, maybe it's not. But I saw the sync video, and so...
Well, it's coming to a new chapter, right? Like, now the acquisition story is coming to a conclusion, right? The actual the actual side of what's going to happen is like just getting going, right? Like this is, I don't know. This is probably the first third of the book when it gets written, right?
Yeah.
We still have the other two thirds of what the fuck's actually going to happen.
Do you think he's serious about laying off, what was it, like 75% of the workforce?
I don't know. It's hilarious that he's like walking in with smiles and like, you know, I saw something the CMO was encouraging people to go over and like say hi to Elon, the CMO of Twitter. And it's like, yeah, that guy that just like casually joked about laying off, you know, three quarters of you. Go say what's up.
The issue with that statement is you don't know which 75%. It's not like he was like, I'm going to lay off this 75%. And so the other 25% could feel comfort. When you say it's with 75%, 100% of the workforce is probably paranoid.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
right?
I mean, 100% of people are like, yeah. I bet if you went, LinkedIn probably has amazing data, but if you went and like saw who has pristine LinkedIn profiles from people on Twitter, it's going to be a very high number. Like every person that has a job, to have a job at Twitter is to have a very good and up-to-date LinkedIn profile right now. and so I think 100% of the people there are at least prepared for this. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, we've talked about content and all that. Like this could have a full-time podcast. Tesla has a full-time podcast that like ranks pretty high. And like Twitter now under Elon, like probably should have at least a weekly podcast dedicated to like all the machinations of what's going on and like the news of it. I mean, certainly a big enough platform to support it. And like, there's going to be enough news going on here with some of the stuff that they're doing, right? And then there's, if I were a reporter, there's certainly going to be enough people with incentive to like leak information here until he like cleans house, right? So I never thought we would end up at this point when it first got going. And then I only thought we would end up at this point over the last like 6 weeks. And so it's interesting to see us actually like get to the finish line on all this. And it seems like the banks are all going to commit. I guess Elon's a good enough client for them that they're going to just take the loss and figure it out. All the equity partners seem like they're going to commit. I know Sequoia's come through and said they were going to. I think Andreessen Horowitz has. I think the Binance CEO was indicating that he was going to as well. So feels like they're going to be able to like...
Larry Ellison?
I haven't heard if Ellison's going to do it. But at this point, it seems like enough people... I don't know. I mean, we're recording this on Thursday midday, right? And it's supposed to close tomorrow afternoon. And so my assumption is with 99.99999%, like tomorrow afternoon, it's going to be done. So,
well, it's been interesting to follow along all the leaked tweets and the stories, and it'll be cool to see what happens next.
Yeah, never a shortage of content or information. So at some point we might get tired of talking about it, but never a shortage of stuff going on there.
Yeah, the Larry Ellison exchange that got me when he was like, I don't know much about how these things actually work, but he was asking for money essentially from his rich friends. And then he reaches out to Larry Ellison and he's like, hey, it's oversubscribed. I need to kick some people out. How much do you want to go in for? And Larry Ellison is like, $1 billion or whatever, trust you, like said something to that effect. I probably got it wrong, but like just casually like, yeah, like $1 billion or whatever,
yeah.
Whatever you need.
What's $1 billion among friends, right? Anyway, so yeah. Well, never a dull moment around there. So everyone's going to, I think, enjoy this episode with Jason Calacanis. Thank you to him for coming on. And look forward to you hearing it now. Jay Cal, how you doing?
I'm good.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. Long overdue. Big fan of the pod.
Long overdue. You would think I would have like my list of questions already, and given how long I bugged you to do this, but I have a feeling the amount of overlap we have and the amount of stuff we can talk about, we might need to shoot from the hip a little bit here.
I think I'm qualified to do that, and it seems like you're very qualified to do that as well.
Marginally so. Where in the world are you?
I live in the Bay Area.
Yeah. I know it.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's like I lived in the city for a couple years. I lived in LA for 10 years. And then before that, Brooklyn and New York City. Where are you?
I am actually in our San Francisco office on Maiden Lane, which is why you're seeing this interesting wallpaper. Normally, I'm not set up like this, but yeah. And then I'm on the Lower East Side, so we can wrap New York. Yeah. I would love to hear at some point.
I got a lot of New York stories, good ones too.
I mean, we can dive right into it. You were at the peak of the original Silicon Alley, right, back in the day.
Yeah,
and now it feels like there's a energy right now that I don't know what it was like back then, but have you been back to New York recently?
I come back a couple times a year. My family's all there. In the 90s, New York City was awesome because you had a number of different industries emerge: hip-hop, CD-ROMs, online services, eventually the internet, media, and really the startup culture of the day was something called zines.
Oh yeah.
Which was short for magazines. And so yeah. I had started two zines when I was 22 and 24. And the first one was called Cyber Surfer. And that was about online services. This is before the internet, before the web browser really existed. And then I did a magazine called Silicon Alley Reporter, which started as a 16-page photocopy newsletter and then eventually grew to a 300-page glossy going out to 100,000 people with 12 million a year in revenue and 100 employees, and did that all on my credit cards. And I did New York to a degree that was, you know, intense. I was on Charlie Rose on the cover of the New York Times, you know, had a New Yorker feature, you know, like I did it.
What was the cover? I mean, you've had like, how many different acts have you had at this point of like being famous for different things? Because I mean, that was you and Mark Andreessen being barefoot on the cover of Time. I feel like that was the, you know, that was the original internet back then. Yeah. So what was the context of being on the New York Times?
They basically did a story about I was on twice in the early days of the internet. And one was for a conference I did called Ready, Set, Pitch. And so in 1996, I had Ted Leonsis from AOL come to a loft that my friend Josh Harris had for a company called Sudo.com, which was an online radio.
Is this Josh Harris of Apollo?
Josh Harris of We Live in Public, which was an art project he did. You know, the internet and like Andy Warhol's factory and all that kind of converged in Lower Manhattan, on Houston Street and like Broadway. And on 600 Broadway, a guy named Josh Harris, who had created Jupiter Communications, which was Jupiter Research. It was like a research company. He started something called Sudo Online Radio. And he started a radio network on the internet. Now, this is during the dial-up era, but he had done something very interesting. He had online chat rooms on Prodigy. This is when Prodigy was maybe $5 an hour. And then he rented Time on WEVD over on Esther Place. And I would go on, and he would have me read the top 10 websites on the internet. And it was Cyber Surfer's top 10 websites. I was completely nervous. Like, and I would be reading out a URL, you know, this is like harvard.edu/tilde, you know, L Barrett, you know, blah, 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 Bartlett, da, da, da. And I would be giving these long URLs and just talking about the internet. And that was like a very special time because nobody was doing it for money. It was all because we thought it was fascinating. We wanted to see what web browsers and online services could do. Of course, broadband happened. Money happened and all that stuff. But I had done this like very interesting event where I had seven people pitch companies to Microsoft, AOL, et cetera. And so that's when I realized like I was really interested in media.
Did you fall into that? Because I mean, you grew up in New York. Once upon a time, you were going to go be a police officer. And so like, how did you go from police officer to New York Times? Can you link those two things together?
Yeah, I think some people in the industry would have preferred if I had become a cop.
you know, I mean, there's still time.
There's still time. Well, what happened was I grew up in Brooklyn. My dad owned a bar and was a bartender. My mom was a nurse. And I was going to school at night at Fordham University at Lincoln Center, but I couldn't afford to pay for it because my dad, through a series of events, had his bar seized from him during the 1987 market crash because he couldn't pay his bills. And then he got in arrears for tax debt. And so he said to me in my senior year of high school, hey, listen, I'm sorry. I got no cash. I'm probably going to jail or might be going to jail. Take care of your mom and good luck in college, son. And so this is 6 weeks before the semester started. So instead of going to Fordham during the day, I went at night. And then I fixed laser printers during the day. But when I would take the train into Manhattan over the Manhattan Bridge, I'd take the B train from Bay Ridge, the R train to the B train, I would always see people reading magazines. And then I wondered, like, how do people get on the cover of a magazine? And then I looked at the masthead and I was like, what's an editor in chief? What's a publisher? What's an editor at large? I kind of became obsessed with it.
What year is this?
This is 1992, 93. And I was going to school at night, like I said, and fixing laser printers. And then the internet happened, and I, through a series of events, having worked at Fordham's computer room, I had been on BitNet and ARPANET and, you know, all the precursors to the commercial internet. So I had just seen like the send command and Gopher and news groups and all this stuff. And then the browser happened and I was like, well, this is interesting. And the browser didn't even support images. Long story short, I started this magazine, this zine called Cyber Surfer. That lasted 5 issues. And then I started the Silicon Alley Reporter because I had a couple of friends who were starting internet companies. And I had met a guy named Jerry Colonna, who's partners with a guy named Fred Wilson. And they were starting Acme Ventures. And they had me reading business plans for them while I was doing the zine. And I read like the business plan for Beverly Hills Internet, which became GeoCities, which was a big hit for them. And I had a choice to either go venture or keep doing my magazine. I chose the magazine, probably not the most economically sound thing to do. I could have been a VC maybe at 23 or 24. But I loved it. I loved being in media, and I built that company.
Being tied to Fred Wilson, I think that would have worked out, and Jerry as well, yeah. I guess. But I think that would have worked out for you.
Could have been okay.
All roads lead back to VC eventually.
Yeah, basically.
I'm fascinated by that moment in time. Did you know like this was actually something uniquely special? I guess it's hard to have sort of historical context when you're whatever 22, yes. 23, 24. You knew that it was something.
Absolutely.
Do you equate it to? I mean, people always draw the analogy to Bitcoin and crypto today, like. Actually trying to be as prescriptive about those two things, does that actually feel similar? Does that fall apart when you actually think about it from your perspective?
If we're talking about like the early days of Bitcoin when nobody cared about money, there were no ICOs, there was no grifting or, you know, bag holding.
Yeah,
sure.
10 years ago.
Yeah. 10 years ago, sure. It felt like people were tinkering with the technology to just see what it could do. Of course, everything gets corrupted by money. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, if the browser had money built into it, of course, you know, and security is built into it, you could have had the internet get corrupted in that 1.0 era. But it did get corrupted by, you know, these IPOs of companies that had no revenue. So in that way, it was very analogous that a bunch of grifters came in, IPO'd a bunch of, you know, bad products, and then you had the dot-com bust. So that arc was correct in the same way crypto is. Of course, you know, crypto hasn't really proven much value outside of, and I know there's a reoccurring theme here on cartoon avatars.
Yeah.
You know, crypto needs to prove some use case and value other than I can sell 100 million in tokens to the, you know, retail investors and pretend it's not a security while I cash out.
Yeah.
Not that I have strong feelings on it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's one of the things that, I mean, the use cases, if you go back and look, like people could at least project what the exact use cases seem to have been. If you go read probably your zine back in the day for the internet, right?
Community is what we used to call it. And, you know, then social media became what community was. So we just envisioned community as message boards or virtual spaces like something called the Palace, which was like 2D avatars walking around with little chat bubbles over their head or virtual places. So we saw community, we saw social networking early, we saw e-commerce early.
That was the metaverse back then, those little bubbles over your head. Gosh.
So much better than Zucks. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. History rhymes altogether. It comes back around on all that stuff. Now, what was the path into media? Did you have some innate? I mean, I guess VC was such a cottage industry at that point, and especially doing it in New York, probably felt a little unusual. But what did was there some gravitational pull that existed there? Do you feel like it was more natural to you?
I knew nothing about it. I'm self-taught. And so I taught myself how to do PageMaker to lay stuff out. I taught myself how to write, taught myself how to take pictures. And it really like informed me as an entrepreneur and informs my investing as an entrepreneur. I think a big part of being an entrepreneur is being fearless about adding skills and, you know, being able to break down what skills it takes to build a product. And in that case, a magazine took writing, it took selling ads, it took taking pictures and laying its stuff out, and then eventually distribution. And so I just tried to master all of those things. And I did it over, you know, 6 or 7 years. And none of them were too hard. And I believe you can get to 60 or 70% proficiency in any discipline if you just put your mind to it. That doesn't mean you're going to become great at it, but you only really need 60, 70% to be able to figure out who has the 80 or 90% that you could hire. And so I did everything in the first couple of issues when it was a zine, quickly learned it. And most of all, just learned the power of media, exactly how media can make you very powerful and influential very quickly. Because I went from being an outsider and a nobody to having all the Harvard HBS kids who were raising venture capital and who wanted to be on the cover of the magazine you know, basically trying to lobby us to get into the magazine. And it was quite deliberate in that I created something called the Silicon Alley 100. And I was like, oh, okay, these folks don't accept me. I'm just going to rank them. So I'm going to create the Silicon Alley 100. And people were like, okay, create the 100. And then I told my team, okay, now tell me who's number one, who's number two. And like, we shouldn't rank. It's too divisive. And people are going to be really upset. And I was like, great, let's start the ranking process. And I basically just, you know, put everybody in their place by taking the number one company, which was DoubleClick. That was the consensus pick because they'd raised the most money. And then I put Esther Dyson as number one, who had kind of led the industry before DoubleClick even was there. And I said, this is going to make everybody lose their mind because they say, how is one angel investor more important than DoubleClick, the most important company? And I just came up with a justification. She was here before them and she set the stage and she laid the foundation. And then I learned that lists are completely not important and they're made just to tweak people. So when founders I invested in now are like, can you write my recommendation to get on the 30 under 30, 40 under 40, 50 over 50, whatever bullshit. I'm just like, sure.
Yeah.
It's meaningless. Get back to work. None of this matters.
So you did all that. Do you sell a company to AOL?
So after that, I did a company called Weblogs Inc. So after Silicon Alley crashed and burned, I sold the company to Dow Jones. I got 2 years of salary. And then I watched blogging occur because two of my employees had gone on to do blogs. Shenny Jardin worked for Silicon Alley Reporter doing events, and then she did Boing Boing. And then Rafat Ali went and did paid content. And I thought, these blogs are stupid. Like, yep. There's no editor. There's no office. You're just doing this at home in your underwear. But then I found out they were making like 10 grand a month each off the advertising. And I was like, well, that's more than I paid them. And they own these properties. Blogs are going to be a thing. And I had an acquaintance named Nick Denton who had started a vlog called Gawker.
Yeah. He's made news for himself since then.
Yeah. And I was like, hey, Nick, can I talk to you about blogs? I want to start business-to-business blogs. And I started business-to-business blogs.
When was this?
This 2003, maybe.
Okay.
Time period, you know, right after the dot-com bust, 9/11. New York was a pretty dark place. Yeah. You know, it was really like a trough in the industry. It's actually kind of starting to feel like that to me now, where people are giving up and throwing the cards and kind of giving up. But I mean, it was everybody in the industry gave up. Like 98% of people just stopping doing any entrepreneurial stuff. That's what happened after the dot-com bust, which is distinctly different than now. But it's similar in some ways to the way people feel like this will never come back. But what was interesting about that time was, you know, we had a discussion about it. And then he wrote like some blog post that I was like, going to be the worst thing that ever happened to blogs because I'm going to commercialize them and put advertising on them. Now, that was a very controversial thing to do, to build multiple blogs. And I said, well, I'm going to be like a B2B publisher. I'll do like 100 of them. I told him, I think I can do like 100 of these in all these different niches. And so I was like, oh, so Nick attacked me publicly. And so then I just, yeah.
So you had a private conversation with Denton and then he
wrote a blog post.
Attack he published.
Yeah.
Gosh, man, that guy.
Yeah. Nick is sharp elbow, but I appreciate that about him. We remain frenemies. I really think like as publisher to publisher, he's extraordinarily talented. But yeah, that was a like, you know, you're walking out of the restaurant and the person just hits you with the bat in the back, you know, like you get jumped in the alley kind of situation.
Yes.
So I was like, okay.
For people that don't know, Nick Denton founded Gawker and was ultimately bankrupted from Gawker because of, I guess, a serendipitous set of events.
That involved
Peter Thiel and Hulk Hogan and Bubba the Love Sponge as well.
And a sex tape, everything. Yeah, it was pretty.
Sex tape. And it makes for a great story.
Pretty extraordinary. It would make for a great season of Succession.
That's right. Yeah. Now, I think that's coming. Bubba the Love Sponge is season 5. So that's fascinating. So you started doing B2B blogs. And what is B2B blogs? I mean, I realize this is hard to contextualize today. Blogs even sounds like such a dated term.
Well, blogs at the time were personal weblogs. So it meant a web page with a log file on it. So you'd make a weblog. So we called it Weblogs Inc. And we started one on Wi-Fi, this new technology that people were installing. So we did Wi-Fi.weblogs.inc. We did Apple.weblogs.inc. So I said, these subdomains would be a cool way to do it. I was very influenced by about.com that Scott Kernan had created and became a very large website in Web 1.0. So I started building these. And then I was like, you know, I got to get my revenge on Nick Denton. And so I tried to hire Elizabeth Spires, who was running Gawker. And so I said, hey, can I buy you a drink? And I said, I know he's paying you like $2,000 a month. He said, no, more like $1,000 or something. And I said, okay, I'll pay you $2,000 and I'll buy you a MacBook Air, because the MacBook Air had just come out or something. And she's like, yeah, no, I'm going to go work for New York Magazine. I was like, hey, listen, kid, like, you're in blogs. That's the future. You're going to go work at New York Magazine. You'll be like the 150th most important person. She's like, she was still enamored with magazines. So she went and she had left Gawker for that. And then a friend of mine said, hey, you know, you picked the wrong target. All the money at Gawker's being made by their second blog. I said, what's the second blog? I didn't know the second blog. They said, it's called Gizmodo. I said, okay, who's running that? They said, Peter Rojas. I said, okay, can you introduce me? You introduce me. I take Peter out to dinner at Jewel Baku, a famous little sushi place on the Lower East Side back in the day. And I said, I'll pay you double. I'll give you the MacBook Air. Come work for me. I'll give you equity. He said, yeah, Nick said he would give me equity. He never gave me equity.
Yep.
So anyway, I hired Peter Rojas and we created Engadget, which became much larger, like 10 times larger than Gizmodo. And Peter, when we sold that, Mark Cuban was my only investor in the company. And when we sold the company, Peter made millions of bucks. And my partner and I, Brian, made millions of bucks. And that was my first big win that I got on the board. And yeah, that was my second act, I guess, as it were, after Silicon Valley Reporter.
When did you sell it?
2006, maybe. We sold it for $30 million 18 months after we started it to AOL, which to Ted Leonsis and Jim Bankoff. Jim Bankoff was like Ted Leonsis' right-hand man. Then Jim Bankoff took the team from Engadget, et cetera, and the playbook and did Vox and Verge and bought a bunch of blog assets that are now Vox. And so he made me my first money, and then he took the playbook and built an even bigger company now.
Yeah.
With the Verge and everything else.
Were you quasi, what's the new term now? I think Taylor Lorenz termed it like niche internet micro, NIMBY or whatever, niche internet micro influencer.
Celebrity.
Yeah.
You know, before influencer, sure. Yeah. I mean, in New York, I was known for the magazine. If you had a magazine, that would be the equivalent in the 90s of being an influencer, right? But also entrepreneur. So it was like kind of having a startup and being an influencer. Blogs were the equivalent of that in Web 2.0, as we called it. And then today, probably podcasting is the third part.
Did you call it Web 2.0 at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody called it Web 2.0. Yeah. And it was like, it was a good moniker because the web became more advanced, like Ajax and refreshing of web pages and cloud computing started to happen. So building websites, you know, as you know, from the history of venture, we went from having to rack and stack servers. And if you raised money, you spent your first $500,000 or $1 million on an office. And another $500,000 or $1 million on servers to, I can, you know, get an office share and, you know, a green desk or whatever and just put up, a cloud, you know, I could rent space in a co-location facility, which eventually became cloud computing. So yeah, it just changed the economics.
Numbering anything. I mean, it's great. It's smart what the Web3 guys have done. Like anything being the next number makes the prior, it's kind of pejorative to the prior one. So it seems like you were on the cutting edge of of that way back when. Now, when did the This Week in Startups, when did you start podcasting and do it all? Because this was starting to get going. Podcasts really started in earnest, what, 2007
or 8, I think, actually. And so there's a guy named Dave Weiner in New York who created the RSS standard, which then became the backbone of Twitter and blogging. And Ev Williams, if you remember from Twitter, did blogger.com previously. So we were all kind of hanging out together. And this standard, at some point, he said, well, we can put an attachment on it. And why would you do that? And so your RSS feed catcher, dedicated software you had to download the blog posts, and you could read them on planes or when you were offline, could then have an attachment. And then the attachment would then get stored on your hard drive. And then somebody was like, well, what if you stored it in the iTunes place, and then you had your podcast download the MP3 file. And that connection that people made became podcasting, and the term pod comes from the iPod. And there's that famous video of me at the All Things D conference asking Steve Jobs that you've probably seen that's gone viral a couple of times.
We could probably splice it in right here as well. It's a great video.
One other thing, will you be able to add any RSS feed to the, or any podcasts RSS feed to iTunes, or is it only through the store?
Oh, you'll be able to add anything you want, completely open. We're just working with the open standards out there, yeah.
And will you help companies like ours sell podcasts, you know, be an Audible? So if we wanted to sell a podcast through your service, would you help us do the fulfillment?
You know, we're planning on having all the podcasts be free at first, but zing me an email with what you've got in mind, and we're open to anything.
Same email I always send it to you?
Yep.
Okay, you got it.
The funny thing about that is I did have Steve's email, and I did trade emails with Steve because Engadget frequently got into hot water with Steve, especially with the iPhone 4 gate when the antenna gate happened. He was not pleased. So he sent me a couple flame emails. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Funny times.
I appreciate people that are that rich and powerful still holding grudges, and being like petty about the slights that journalists take at them. It's something I hold near and dear to my heart, just when people don't let things go like that.
He was full contact, you know, he was going to let you know his opinion. And he didn't shy away from talking to people. It wasn't like these new CEOs that hide, you know, and never talk to the press. Like he was just loved talking to the press in a way that most founders just don't want to engage with them. And then at that time, the press was a little more, collegial with the subjects, because tech was like a very niche thing. It was like people who were into iPods and computers were like this small subset. You know, the general public wasn't really into computers. They might use one at work, but it wasn't like today where everybody had a computer in their pocket and it was impacting society and elections and yeah, whatever, you know.
The influence of tech, it was like this nerdy sort of cottage industry that maybe you dealt with at work, right? You went, to some extent, like Jobs and Gates and Michael Dell, and there were a handful of those like whiz kids that got a ton of coverage, even Andreessen, right? Yeah. But it wasn't 100%. There wasn't the level of cynicism that there is now, it feels like, where in the last 5 years, it feels like the tone of assuming best intent has like totally gone out the window. And now it's like assuming worst intent from a lot of news sources about founders and intentions. And, you know, in some cases, rightfully so, I guess.
In some cases, rightfully so. In some cases, it's just because it's a popular thing to do, is to beat up on capitalism or entrepreneurship. In a lot of cases, it's unfair, you know, like, and the percentage of coverage of very cool things being built, you can just look at your portfolio.
Like, yep.
Whatever company makes a mistake in your portfolio is going to get 100 stories. And then the other 99 companies in your portfolio that do amazing work in the world, make no mistakes, are going to get zero coverage. And you're going to say to some journalist, like, hey, would you cover this? And they're like, yeah, why would I cover that when I could cover the latest missteps of Uber? You know, like, that's going to get more clicks. And so, you know, the press moved from being really interested, and I was a member of the press, just really interested in the innovations. And you still have some real press that do that. But I would say by and large, people are very cynical, and the impact of tech just hits everywhere. And it's just a different world today when you have tech impacting employment the way it does, elections the way it does, news and the truth, you know. And really, if you look at it deeply, the press got hollowed out by the tech industry, and there is a longstanding grudge there. And most people don't realize that, but having been through it and been on the other side of watching tech do it, watching America Online, you know, take away access to users, then watching Google take away all your advertising, watching Facebook take away all your advertising, eBay and Craigslist take away the marketplace known as classifieds, you just watched your entire business get gutted out. And people will say, like, well, that's nonsense. But yeah, I think there's a very intrinsic grudge between the tech industry and what they were able to accomplish and what they did in terms of gutting out the media business. And it still exists to this day.
You think that's where the resentment resides versus just like the power and the money and influence that comes with all these algorithms and all the dollars accumulating to a handful of people? Or do you think it's some of both?
I think that was like the second piece that kind of tweaked people. The first piece was like, hey, these guys just ate our lunch. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch's like, why would we index our stuff in Google? And why does Google get to give you these snippets of our stories and then people don't actually click through? Or why is Apple mitigating our subscriptions and we don't get the subscription information when they sell an app? We don't have the person's contact information. So there's this longstanding kind of who controls the pipes to the customer. And you know, subscriptions in New York Times, some people have done a good job of maybe mitigating against that eventually,
yeah.
But it's been hollowed out. You know, same thing happened in the music business. And so it took a little while for that equilibrium. And I think that equilibrium is happening right now with Substack and podcasts. I think some of the traditional press still are, you know, if you were to look at the New York Times, probably 4 out of 5 stories are extremely negative on tech. And then you look at podcasts, you find even the New York Times podcast, you might find in podcasting a more nuanced, more accurate, I would say, approach. You know, these pieces where they attack the Away founder. You remember that one in the New York Times?
Steph's a friend, and I was the first maybe institutional, if not first actual investor in a way. So I remember it very well.
Well, I mean, you look at that instance and it's like, okay, she told the customer support team, we need to work hard during Christmas because that's when our customers need us and that's what pays our salary. And everybody needs to buck up and work hard. CEO that I've invested in says that, I give them a high five, right? Good job. You read them the rally cry. You told them, hey, get serious. If you're not serious, get out of here. Like, this is what why we're here. And then all of a sudden, she's a racist. Like, they painted her as being a racist or being like a B word, you know, like all these things they do to women. And it's like, this is completely unfair. And it's not true. It's obviously not true. You're making this shit up.
That's one that's like the nearest and dearest, I guess, to me, just because I knew her before she started the company. We were just friends in New York when we were like 22, 23 year olds, right? And like, you know, I was in finance. She was working at Warby Parker at the time, right? She ended up marrying a buddy of mine as well. And watching someone go through that was like that. When you see someone hit like that, just so unnecessarily, it really makes you cynical to the power that other people have, right? And we're seeing these democratization of platforms and distribution of information that have really negative effects when people are debating fundamental truths in some cases, right? About elections and whatever.
Yeah.
But then how many of these instances, like just careers and lives ruined because of misrepresentation in some way, shape, or form by the media, by the press, or whatever? So,
yeah, it just seemed really unfair. It seemed like a double standard. And it felt like, you know, all these anonymous sources, we weren't in the early days of journalism, you know, and I was coming up, they would be like, yeah, you can't use anonymous sources. You got to get two people on the record, three people on the record. And now it's like, yeah, we got a couple anonymous sources, but they're scared of the ramifications. Therefore, we can print this. So I think there needs to be some rethinking of this. And then, you know, people are just not going to let themselves be canceled anymore. I think if the Away thing happened today, I think maybe the board or, you know, the shareholders around that in the company might stand behind her.
Yeah.
And be like, you know what? Who cares what the New York Times says? Like, and you've seen that since. Like, people have tried to do hit pieces on, you know, different founders. And they're like, yeah, whatever, you know?
People just move on. Yeah.
Just move on. It doesn't matter. Like, it's sure. Okay. And even if it was true, even if I, you know, berated five people on my team, like, you're not doing a good job. You guys are idiots. Which I've done in my career, you know, earlier in my days, like, I've told people, like, this is terrible work. You're going to ruin the magazine. Like, I literally kicked somebody out of my office. I was like, go home. I am disgusted by this effort. Like, if I did that today, it would probably be a headline story. But in the 90s, if you told somebody, like, listen, this is not the quality of work we expect here. You're fired. Like, that's what you expect if you did a bad job. So I don't know what's going on with the sort of benchmark of this, but that one seemed profoundly unfair, and it's continued. But when there's a reaction to that, which is people now are tuning into podcasts to get their information, and a lot of the podcasts are by the subjects. Now, I'm unique in that I'm a journalist who was an entrepreneur.
Yeah, what do you consider yourself, by the way? Are you investor or journalist?
Sure, whatever you like, yeah. I mean, I was one of the first folks to say, like, what does it matter? Like, I'm a journalist turned entrepreneur. I was an entrepreneur journalist. I was an entrepreneur who learned how to be a journalist, who did media, and then started angel investing. So, you know, pick whatever you want. But it's become quite a playbook now, from what I understand, this media plus investing thing.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, it's an interesting, I mean, you were obviously were on the forefront of doing a lot of this stuff. And the podcasting thing is interesting where it's still the tools, as we've seen from cutting out here once already to give people a little bit of the sausage making, the tools are still in their infancy. And I've gone back and forth with your nephew, Nick, about some of the stuff you guys do and use for All In and This Week in Startups and all that. And like, no one's really packaged it together in like a fully integrated way. That's like one. And I realize it's a very hard problem, especially as video gets introduced as well. You know, these different files and recording and internet speeds and all that. Like, I don't mean to make it an easy problem, but I mean, when you were getting going back in the day, you were recording locally on like Skype calls or something, I assume, with people.
Yeah, we did Skype. It was basically, I had a TriCaster. So I invested in a $20,000 media video switcher that they would use at like churches and stuff like that to make videos. And so, yeah, I had done something called Calacanis Cast for like 30 episodes and then changed it to This Week in Startups after being on Leo's This Week in Tech. And I became like a hit on that podcast where he was a video show. So before podcasts, there were video shows like Dig Nation. And after Dignation and This Week in Tech, podcasting came out and people were like, oh, okay, we can put those shows over here. But video was something people didn't really want to do because it added maybe 100 times the complication and 50 times the cost.
Totally.
As you've quickly learned, you know, the time to get an audio podcast out is like hours. Time to get a video podcast out is like days, depending on how many full-time people you have. So it's getting there though. I mean, the tools that are out here now, like, Restream or, you know, all of these different tools are, they're getting pretty robust. Right. And so it's close.
When did This Week in Startups or Calacanis Cam, which sounds far dirtier than it is.
But no, Calacanis Cast. Oh, Cast.
Good. Calacanis Cam sounds like something that I don't want to see. Calacanis Cast sounds great.
Yeah. I don't think anybody needs to see Calacanis Cam.
That's our own private feed that we have. So that was going on.
Yeah. I think Brian Alvey was the first guest on This Week in Startups.
In 2000?
2010.
Okay.
2010. So 12 years ago. And it was weekly. And then it went to twice a week, three times a week. And then the last 2 years, I told my team, if you sell out the ads, I'll do a fourth episode if you get to like 3 to 6 months sold out. And I enjoyed doing it so much that I just did a fourth day a week, a fifth day a week, and then a sixth day a week. And then I hired Molly Wood to join me.
When did Molly came on when?
January 1st of this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were doing once a week, which is where I am right now, which I can only imagine. I'm probably 12 years behind you in all of this stuff.
You're doing great. I listen to most episodes. The crypto ones are a little bit intense.
Like, yeah. The Sam West.
I'm glad you got off the crypto thing. That was getting a little much. Yeah.
We jumped off.
Yeah, good move. Good move.
It's hard because you get the audience that you create, right? And so if like people are coming for cable news style, yeah, crypto dunking and fighting, then that's the group that you're going to have, right? And you can't really switch up off of that. So
it was a good move to detour off of it. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to blow my brains out. So yeah.
Good pivot.
But so you were doing it once a week and then just kept ramping it up. And was it just something that had it been a steady growth for you over time and kind of evolving the format, or how much of a business was it versus your own personal enjoyment?
Yeah, it was my own personal enjoyment. I had grown up on Charlie Rose and Howard Stern, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and they were on every day. And I would listen to Howard and, well, he was in the afternoons to start, and then the morning on like terrestrial radio. And then eventually went to Sirius, and then Charlie was on at night. So I really was obsessing over those two. And I liked Mike Wallace and Oprah and some other folks who I thought were really good at interviewing people. And I was like, wow, that'd be a cool job. And then I was on Charlie Rose eventually. I'd never been on Howard Stern, but, and I actually became friends with Charlie, and I did a conference with him back in the 90s when he was getting into tech. Yeah, it was kind of cool at the time. It was kind of tragic what happened and horrible. But he was a real institution in New York, and I studied them. And then I was always like, wow, you know, I would have loved to do a radio show every day. Seems like the most fun you could ever have. And sure enough, for me, it is. It's not for everybody, but every day I wake up, I can't wait to get on air. I read some stories. And then in terms of for my day job, investing in companies, my Lord, is it, as you've learned, you know, people didn't know who you were, maybe a little bit from the comedic Twitter stuff you did. And that was a good start. But I think now people know you from the pod. And I've had two or three people say like, you know, hey, this pod's really good.
Yeah, it's a much more whole, like the depth of getting someone to listen to a pod is obviously a pretty intimate relationship that you're developing with someone, right? Versus looking at 140 characters, you're only able to be one dimensional for the most part,
sure.
Especially if you're fucking around like I was.
Yeah.
And so it's, yeah, it's definitely had a more holistic element of like getting to know me in the depth of relationship.
I feel you're like almost fully 2D now. So
yeah,
I feel
yeah,
like
good.
You're on the
yeah,
way.
That's good.
You're almost there to a full avatar.
That's all I have at this point. You know,
2.3. You'll be there.
Being able to hold people their interest and have opinions and be interesting consistently, especially 5 days a week as you're talking about stuff. I mean, I see people do it all the time on politics and sports. Our world is, it's interesting because you have a leg in both sides of this, right? You can bring an investor perspective, you can bring an entrepreneur's perspective, and then you can also be a proverbial talking head about some of these things. And you're able to give like a little bit of an inside lens. you're also willing to mix it up a little bit. I think you got your, people got their punches in and you got very comfortable in your own skin. I feel like in the 90s, right? Your first go round of all this stuff.
Yeah. It's not my first go around. So yeah. If somebody gets upset by something I say to the point at which they dunk at me at my own conference and then can't get over it for a year and go on 10 podcasts to talk about it, I'm like, dude, take a deep breath.
That's
like,
a friend of mine.
Take a deep breath, Palmer.
me and Palmer, we did not.
That was a great interview.
Thank you. I did not go the J-Cal route on the interview session just because I felt like there was so much embroiled in that even touching the stove on it felt like.
No. I thought you did a good job of getting him to finally talk about why he was fired, right? And, you know, when I had him on the All-In stage, which, you know, for people who don't know, I had said on my podcast, if we want to rehash it, you know, somebody was like, hey, listen, he backed this thing, you know, that was kind of like shitposting on Reddit and, you know, during the Hillary Clinton, Trump, you know, kind of debates and everything. And I was like, you know, if you're the CEO of a company, it's a really dumb thing to do anonymously. If you're going to do it, you should do it like with your name on it. And if you're not doing it with your name on it, it's kind of dumb because that should tell you, like, you probably shouldn't be doing it.
He was supporting, like, I don't want to say violent trolling, but extreme trolling would be the way to do it.
That's right. And his comment about it was really insensitive, kind of that it was almost maybe not super ideologically driven as much as it was, like, fun for him.
What an idiot.
Well, it actually lost them a fair amount of business. There were about three or four game studios that said, right, we're no longer developing for the Oculus on this one. Because he came out and said, basically, well, to overturn an entrenched elite, then you need to be able to fund it and fight back. And you're like,
what an idiot.
That's not, you're not a revolutionary. This is just HIT posting about politicians. This is not constructive dialogue. This is not an attempt to reform the American political scene. This is just, oh, let's be a troll.
Yeah, if you want to see like a person's true character, give them a pile of money or a bunch of power, and then you will see.
And like, think about your family. Think about the people who work for you. Think about their families. If they find out you're doing this like posting or whatever, and you know, it's these kind of dank memes from Reddit, that's going to blow up in your face and it's going to cause your family all these problems. So it's just idiotic. And he really took that personal. And I was like, dude, listen, I based this on a story that was in like, you know, 10 newspapers. If they're wrong, I'm totally fine saying my commentary on that is wrong. But, you know, he took it real personal. I understand.
I talked earlier about NPC thinking that prioritizes popularity over principles. What I'm about to do is in very, very bad taste, but I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah, we'll see. One of the people who I think embodies this type of NPC thinking of going with what's popular and not being willing to ever reverse their position even when they're proven wrong is Jason Calacanis. Let me read about some of the things he's said about me over the years. Just a small sampling. Palmer Luckey, hideous. What an idiot. A moron. This guy, Parker Luckey, a complete and utter moron. Jesus, this kid is an idiot.
I love Palmer as an authentic person, and it was one of the more enjoyable conversations I had. And we talked a little bit about this offline, and it was interesting. I think what he was most upset at the reporting of other people, right? And their willingness to not go back to the source. Mm-hmm. But you meant it wasn't so much as, hey, I have all the facts of how this played out. You were saying a CEO that does this.
It's an unforced error, right? Like it's not something, you know, you should do as a leader, because if it does blow up in your face, the collateral damage is large. Now,
yes.
I did listen to it and I was like, oh, that's a little spicy, you know, even for me when I said it. And you know, sometimes you say things that are spicy. And if it's based on false stuff, you know, of course, like tell me what's wrong. And that's what I did live. I was like, hey, why were you fired? And what was the background here? And he didn't want to talk about that. I get it. But I told him, I was like, listen, I don't take it personal. Like, you know, you just, the way I said it was a little rough. Okay, fine. I apologize. But tell me what's the real story here, you know? And he's never really, I think he's not legally allowed to talk about the real story, if I'm being honest. Like,
that's right. Although I think I got most of it out of him, which I don't know exactly how those two things worked out. But also, I think the the salt in the wound of it, that at least what I gathered was that, well, the delay, which I think had nothing to do with this specifically. I think it was just kind of the hype and all the stuff All In was going through at the time. I think, I don't know. I don't want to speak for you. And then, so the delay led to some consternation. And then the addendum was like, okay, well, you're going to get the last word here. And then whatever back and forth you guys had made it seem almost like it wasn't the apology that he wanted, right, in all of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the apology is, I said it in a very spicy way, sorry. It wasn't meant as personal. It was meant more like, you know, hey, the behavior here, if it is accurate, like, so if I could do it over again, the way I would say it is, if all this is accurate, like,
which it wasn't, or at least as far as I know,
some percentage of it was accurate, some percentage was not, like, as we just talked about with the press. So if I had made this commentary on, let's say, Stephanie, is she the Away CEO?
Yes, yeah.
You know, if somebody made the commentary on Steph and it turns out it was false, which it seems to be, or largely false, or largely over, you know, over dramatized, yeah, you would probably feel bad if you had dunked on her. So I did dunk on him. I apologize for that. And he probably could have, if he could get a do-over, he would do something different, right? Like, he wouldn't have done it, I don't think.
I think he said that, actually. So either on the podcast or not, he was like, listen, my life is now defined by $9,000. And I don't mean to sound like a rich guy, but like, I always fucking have to talk about these $9,000. And so in the grand scheme of things, would I prefer that my legacy be tied to Oculus or Anduril more than this $9,000? Yes, right? So he was very...
Which was my point.
Which actually brings it back to why...
I will say this. So I am glad he's on our side.
Oh my God.
Thank God he's making weapons for us, because he's supremely talented. Like, in the entrepreneurial hall of fame, I'll barely, you know, be admitted, you know, on the last day, and he'll be up there in lights, you know, two unicorn companies, you know, by the time he's 30 years old. I mean, this guy's amazing. And which is what I told him. I was like, dude, what do you care about what I say on my stupid podcast?
And you know what? He's authentically himself, and like, allowing that, you know, what he said, thin skin, insecure billionaire. He's like, yes, I am. But I will say, it is interesting, the platform that you have with This Week in Startups now. And also, I mean, All In is just such a beast in and of itself, right? Every week I look, and it's you guys and Lex Fridman on number one, right? Just week after week on tech. And now Lex is having Kanye West on his show, which I kind of disappointing in my view.
I talked about that in the last All In.
Did you?
I said, like,
okay,
I was like, listen, it's a mistake to platform somebody who's going through mental illness. And I saw Trevor Noah had a similar take, which is, if somebody's obviously public about their mental health struggles, says I'm off my meds, which he apparently said in a couple of his interviews, and he's acting manic, and he's saying crazy stuff that's very hurtful and could cause, you know, real world harm, this is very dangerous. I get death threats once in a while, you know, every couple of years somebody jumps the fence and says something crazy. I have to deal with security issues. It's more polarized now as the number of viewers go up. Can you imagine with like somebody like Kanye West, like, if 1% of his audience is suffering from mental illness and or is racist, right? That seems like a reasonable number. Well, that's a million people. So it's a small percentage. Even if it was 0.001%, it would be 10,000 crazy people / mentally disturbed, like psychotic and or racist, horrible humans, which is two different groups, right?
Yeah.
We feel bad for the mentally ill, and we could feel no sympathy for the racist pieces of garbage. But he's got them in that audience. Law of big numbers. There's 10,000 of them. You know, one of those goes off and, you know, does something horrible. I don't want to say what specifically, but we've all seen bad things happen at places of worship, et cetera. Like, he's got blood on his hands. And then for you to platform him, and I understand, I like Lex, and I understand what Lex is trying to do. He's got a relationship with him. So he was trying to stand up to Kanye and talk sense to him. You're not going to talk sense to somebody who's going through a psychotic episode or whatever his episode is that he has. And Kim Kardashian learned that, right? She divorced him and had to get off that train, apparently. And it's just really sad. So don't, and I don't blame Lex. exactly, but I do blame like other folks who maybe like,
yeah, I don't know.
Platform him. It's just a really dangerous thing to do.
I look up to Lex stylistically in a lot of the things he does, where he just has conversations with people and is so thoughtful about like the work he does in advance and coming in and wanting to have like these authentic conversations that they aren't going to have anywhere else. And so I was bummed that, and I realized I didn't listen to the entirety of it. So I don't want to, speak totally out of school about how it actually played out, but it's unfortunate that someone that's clearly going through something is getting that platform to espouse some of these views. How do you think about your obligation or your responsibility with All In now, like as you guys have veered into politics? I mean, we talked about the Palmer thing, which obviously had some real world implications for him specifically. But that, I assume the listenership of This Week in Startup, certainly 5 years ago or 6 years ago when you were doing it, was
a fraction compared
to All In today. How do you feel about your obligation? I mean, to some extent, you're shaping some of the discourse, right? Be it within tech, be it within politics, be it within, like, do you all have an appreciation for that going into each episode? Because it's evolved beyond buddies shooting the shit and just recording it with at least the implications.
Yeah, I think this is not my first time at the rodeo, having, you know, been in the media for a while. But yeah, for the other three besties, it's definitely a new thing, you know, to varying degrees. And it has gotten bigger than anybody anticipated. It wasn't supposed to be, like, I think last week we're number 26 or 27 on the charts, like overall. So that's kind of bonkers. And it really has, like, with This Week in Startups in San Francisco, I would get asked to take a selfie, you know, if I was out for the day with my kids, you know, once or twice. Now it might be 10 or 20 times. So, and if I, you know, it's a much bigger number in terms of the reach. And I encourage people, when we are talking about markets or startups or venture, or I'm talking about media, sure, consider us experts.
Sure.
You know, we have an area of expertise. That expertise is in capital allocation, startup, company formation, technology, markets. Okay, great. In between the three of us, it's over 100 years of experience in those things. But when it comes to other things, politics, you know, we're probably very similar to a lot of the audience. And there's probably a lot of the audience has more experience than us. But I think one of the things that's interesting is we live in this age of who gets to talk about something, right? Who gets to have commentary on something? Who gets to talk about whether we wear a mask or don't, whether you take the vaccine or you don't, whether, you know, the election was rigged or not, you know, like, are we not allowed to discuss these things? Well, I think everybody should discuss these things. And I think what we try to do on the show, I can't speak for them, but for me, I try to have a really healthy dialogue about hard issues. And people are going to have strong feelings about different ones. And David and I, David Sachs, you know, we disagree fundamentally about a lot of things.
Yeah.
But we're still like very close friends. When people think that we're at each other's throat, like, we, our families hang out together, go on vacations together. Like, we're besties, like, for real. But like, you might have in your family or friend circle, you might disagree, you know, dramatically over certain things. And we try to let that play out a little bit on the podcast. And then hopefully people learn that you can disagree and still be friends and maybe make forward progress. But you know, I've caught lightning in a bottle, you know, a half dozen times in my career. And I can tell you, like, you really don't know. Like, Silicon Valley Reporter became a hit, Engadget became a hit, This Week in Startups, All In became hits. But then you don't see the 20 other projects I've done that didn't become hits, right? And so this one's a hit, and it's quite, you know, interesting how big it's become. And people get a lot of value. And I give you a lot of credit. Like, you when you started your podcast, were like, hey, listen, I really admire what these guys have done, and I want to try some podcasting. And a lot of people copy the format, or, you know, got inspired by it and just never gave any credit. I told you personally, like, wow, that's incredibly nice of you to say such nice things about us and the influence it had on you. And your show is different and great, you know?
I mean, listen, I would not have thought about getting behind a microphone and doing this without you guys having done it, right? And I think we wanted to rip off the form factor with different style and approach, and people that were not as established in their career or well off financially or whatever it was. And I'll tell you, I mean, how well you've been able to, as a group, stay together and keep doing this when you guys don't have to, right? Yeah. From a financial standpoint or from a even name recognition standpoint, and driving the motivations that each person has individually towards a collective output that is this. I mean, I've shared this, but to some extent, Nikita went to go build his app, which is now number one in the App Store, and it's been wild to see that. And then with Zach, there were General Catalyst is a bigger firm, and they have some compliance considerations that made it onerous on me to just like get the product out every week.
Sure.
But we had to evolve the format, and it's that was even with like two people that don't have, or three people that don't have kids, and none of us are married and are early in our careers and have every reason to make a name for ourselves, right? Versus what you guys have of all the different egos and personalities and dollars and families and incentives at like keeping everyone rowing in the same, in any direction, let alone the same direction is, I know it's not been easy along the way, but it's impressive.
It's, you know, when you look at the four individuals, none of us have had a boss in some cases in our entire career. Certainly for me, in my entire career, I only had one boss.
By the way, that's the best quadrant is people that have opinions and don't have bosses. That's like what I look for someone that I want to talk to.
Yeah.
It's they have stuff to say and don't care who hears it, right? And
they don't answer to anybody, right?
Yeah, it's a great quadrant to be in.
It's also a dangerous one to be in, you know, and it has caused downstream effects, I think, for all of us in negative ways at times, and then overall very positive. So I'm raising my fourth fund right now, and the only reason I can say that is I did 506C, like the public raising of a fund.
Yeah, public raising.
And I was like, you know, for my fourth fund, I wonder if I mention it on All In, if I mention it on This Week in Startups that I'm raising a fund, if I'll meet new LPs. And sure enough, got a lot of, you know, emails from folks, and I did a couple of webinars. And the last fund was $44 million, and then I had $40 million in commits after doing 5 hours of webinars without ever going on the road and pitching any of my existing LPs or new ones, just doing a couple of webinars. So the impact on our businesses has been extraordinary, in that when any of us meet with an LP or a founder, it starts with a discussion about All In, whatever the topic we're supposed to discuss, take a pitch from a founder, and then maybe end with a selfie or some more discussion about All In. Or
yep.
I had two founders who said, we're oversubscribed, but we'll let you in if you can get us two tickets to the All In Summit. And I was like, well, the All In Summit is sold out. And they're like, yeah, that's why we want you to give us two tickets to it. And we're sold out too. And I said, wow.
Yeah. It's amazing.
You guys are good. I was like, okay, you get two of my 15 tickets I've been allotted as a bestie. You'll get two of them. And I gave two of them tickets. Molly and I got the deal with this company.
No, that's awesome. Yeah.
It's pretty happy about it.
It's an amazing platform. And I will say, coming in every week, coming up with a list of stuff, and then being willing to talk about those things that you might not be an expert, especially, I mean, Sachs is such a good debater, and being the foil to him when he has, you know, an entire political party's Oppo research backing him up, like your ability to debate someone that has all of that stuff. It's, you know, I mean,
well, and you know, with Sachs, it's like, you know, I've had to, you know, being a media guy, you know, and being the point guard of this, I've had to work with each of them on what it means to be on, you know, what I tell them is like, let's play like the Warriors. Let's pass the ball, you know, the basketball team Warriors.
Yeah.
Let's pass the ball. Let's be selfless. And you'll notice in each of their performances a lot of evolution from the first episodes. And somebody was doing this like All In Stats, where they were tracking how many minutes and monologues we each did with like some AI or whatever. And you saw a lot of monologuing. And now you hear Chamath saying, hey, you know, I was really interested in what Freeberg said. I want to build on that. Sachs, I'm curious what you think about this. So you see that crisp passing of the ball. And, you know, I created kind of the science corner for Freeberg, because he would zone out during politics. Sachs would zone out during science. And so, you know, trying to get everybody their touches has been a new experience for me, because usually I'm either the subject or I'm doing a solo dolo one-on-one interview or doing the news with Molly, you know, two-person game, pick and roll. This is different. And so I base this and the show's format on the McLaughlin Group, which most people are now too young to remember. But the McLaughlin Group was a Sunday show. We had this very cantankerous guy, McLaughlin, who would kind of mix it up with people who were obviously very smart and friendly, but they could get into it, right? And so there's a moment where like getting into it gets too heated and it kind of takes away from the experience. And then there's a moment where like just enough heat makes it interesting and progress gets made. But it's been a great joy for me to do it. I can't believe we got to 100. I didn't think it was going to make it to 100, if I'm being honest.
I think a lot of people didn't for a minute there. I can't believe you came on here to talk about the text messages, Jason.
Yes, not right now. Just give me a couple of weeks on that one.
What do you think the lightning in the bottle of it is as you think about like what's been successful for, obviously you're all independently successful. You all have opinions. You all have relationships that I think people gravitate to and kind of operate in different corners or domains of expertise.
What do you think it is? I wonder.
I think there's a palace intrigue in tech in general right now that I'm trying to tap into to some extent. That if you can help people for how influential tech is, how rich these executives are, meme stocks, crypto, Elon, Dogecoin, all this stuff. If you can help people demystify some of that, I think that there's just big picture, there's something there, right? And people care about that. And so I think that was something that you guys hit well. And then I think there's also the billions element of just like, hey, people are interested in the Kardashians' life. And this is just, there's elements of being on boats or being on planes or, you know, different level of cashmere sweaters and stuff that people tend to enjoy. And then I think there's that element of like opinions, no bosses. And then I think there was COVID as like a big beneficiary of, you know, podcasts and YouTube and people kind of changing their behaviors and habits of listening to things. So I think those are some of them. And then also I think there's probably just this people, I put it in two buckets. People want to be, it's like edutainment or like entertainment and education is sort of what we talk about. And like, I know you talked about this with the acquired guys as well, but you're able to touch on some of that where you make fun of each other. And also people walk away feeling like they weren't empty calories that they just got, right? And so, I don't know, I feel like there's some petri dish of all that stuff, but I'd be interested in what you think.
I think that's what you just sort of analyze is what most people say. The camaraderie of the four of us and being friends and, you know, the laughs and the bits and the, you know, breaking each other's chops on the margins. Like, well, that's kind of funny and you know, not mean-spirited, but funny. And yeah, you learn something, obviously, hopefully. And people are probably struggling with some of these issues in their own life and, you know, trying to understand them, like markets or COVID or whatever it is, meme stocks, crypto. And so if we can help people understand the world a little bit better, yeah, that's great as well. You know, sometimes I think it's just the exceptional moderation of it.
Yeah. The world, what is it? The world's greatest moderator or the world's...
Well, I just started doing that to troll Sax's army of bots because, you know, this big thing like, don't interrupt Sax. And I'm like, well, you know, if Sax goes for 3 minutes and, you know, he goes into his debate mode, at some point I've got to like, you know, he gets kind of worked up as you've seen. And so we came up with a couple of devices. Like one of them is, you may not see this on camera, but I'm doing this sometimes to Sax, which gets edited out. Or anybody who's going on for a while, but this is like, hey, kind of wrap it up.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I have a good sense when somebody's gone on a little bit and they're running out of steam and the audience is like, okay, I get it. You know, you don't like Biden or, you know, you really love, you know, synthetic proteins, whatever.
You and Sax have a safe word together.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just twirl my finger like a wrap it up kind of situation. And then I try to pass the ball to another person and get people involved.
Moderating isn't, you know, I had the Sam Lessin, Zach Weinberg thing.
And yeah, that was a hot one. Yeah.
I kind of forgot my job in like was to be a moderator. And I was just kind of sitting there like being entertained by the whole thing. And I realized
yeah, you forgot. Yeah, I got to referee kinda, this.
And so I kind of look like a doofus because I'm just like sitting there being like, man, they are really mad at each other. Right. And I'm like,
you're like watching Mike Tyson and Holyfield go at it. And you're like, you're supposed to ring the bell, dude. This person's getting pummeled.
I went back and listened, and people are like, I was like, ooh, that wasn't, that's, this isn't going to come off well for me. My, this is not going to show well. And so I increasingly will listen for your moderation style. It's much easier when it's an interview, because there's not a need for, it's just two people. And so stylistically, you don't need to go back and forth in the same way, but actually moderating, especially across a bunch of different people, is a very different and skill that, I've had to learn a little bit.
I was getting brigaded awfully bad by like the MAGA folks and the crypto folks. So I had to like change my Twitter settings to only my people I follow can reply for a little bit, because they were being pretty vicious. And, you know, they think that me asking a question of Sachs and saying, hey, so do you think Biden's responsible for Putin invading? I just want to be clear here. Like, you don't think Biden is responsible for Putin invading Ukraine? And he's like, no, of course I don't think that. So what I'm trying to do here is actually round out maybe some people's positions at times. But I think the audience sometimes, or at least people who are very fervent on one side or the other, might think I'm taking the other position. And Schmuck, like, I'm trying to clarify a position that maybe is going to be misinterpreted. So I look at my role is to get the best out of the other besties, to make sure their positions and what they're saying is crisp, and make sure that the audience understands it. And a lot of times I'm asking questions because I want to make sure the audience understands an acronym, or I want to make sure
you have to go up and down to different altitudes, right? And like your listener, you know, you probably have an archetype of person that you think about to some extent of like who's going to, what level of depth to go to or sophistication on different topics, right?
Exactly.
And maybe you don't explicitly think that way, but like you at least know, hey, if we're really in the weeds of this thing with Freeburg, like I need to pull him back up a little bit about where this is going to operate. And it's funny, I had one the other day that someone got really mad at me. I asked if we thought we were at the end of like podcasts, and that we were reaching kind of a saturation point of the number of podcasts that can exist out there, and like that people actually have time for.
Yeah.
And like, obviously I don't actually believe, like, of course, the extent people want to talk is the same as the people extent people want to blog, the same extent as people want to fucking post on TikTok.
You weren't pulling the ladder up behind you and saying nobody else can join, like, the party. But people will interpret it that
people,
way.
Yeah. People got,
this like, is the end.
They're like, you think that UGC content has a finite, and I'm like, no, I don't think that. I was just asking the question to like get a response. So it is funny how in being a moderator or being an interviewer, people project onto some of these things for you. So give me the weirdest before we go. What's the weirdest part of All In success now for you? I mean, you've been in the public spotlight for a while now. And so the selfies, I'm sure, have gone up.
I love it. I can't take enough selfies. I love the fans. If anybody sees me out in public, you know, even if I'm with my kids, just be normal. Tell me you love the show. We can take a selfie, you know, high fives, whatever. You know, and so I'm kind of built for it. I'm on the Myers-Briggs. Like, I took the test twice. I think I was 96 and 100% extroverted. So if I talk to people, I come on your show, I feel great energy for the rest, you know, for the next 6 hours. So I have no problem with like the micro celebrity nature of this and people recognizing me. And as long as everybody's kind of normal. And I think that's one of the problems in Silicon Valley is sometimes people get famous or rich or whatever, and they stop acting normal. So my advice to people is always stay normal, just be a normal person. Like, you know, none of us are George Clooney here or, you know, whatever, Gwyneth Paltrow. So just chill. But it's been great that people have told us it's helped them have better discussions in their life and made them feel more informed about the world. So it's very rewarding. There's a great paradox to it that, you know, one of the greatest successes of my careers is this non-commercial, you know, weird thing that I have to share with three other people who have three other opinions of which direction to take it. And we had to have like sort of a rules of the road. Hey, listen, let's just do the podcast every week. Forget about the summits, forget about the meetups, forget about any brand extensions. We'll just do that one thing. Let's try to get 100 episodes out, 50 episodes out a year, 100 every 2 years, whatever it is. And just, you know, do a high quality show. And, you know, it's had a rollover effect on my other businesses. So you can't buy ads on All In, but you can buy ads on This Week in Startups. Oh, you know, All In's not going to invest in your startup, but, you know, Chamath or Sachs or I could invest in your startups. And, you know, you can't invest in All In, but, you know, you could be an LP in my fund or whatever. So it's had a great impact otherwise, just, you know, in terms of meeting people, like some serious people listen to the pod. It's kind of weird. like we'll have senators or like Gwyneth Paltrow wrote about it in her Goop newsletter. Like it's very weird. Like it just lands some places. And I was at a party this weekend and somebody came up to me and people were dancing at a party and I'm dancing with my wife. And they're just like, I just wanted to tell you, I listened to All In, but I don't want to disturb you while you're on the dance floor. And I was like, disturb me? What are you talking about? Yeah, you know, like, yeah. It's great.
You're like, this turns me on more than dancing does. Like this is birdie talk.
Yeah, it's great. Let's go. So, I mean, I love it. And, you know, I feel so grateful for my life. Like as a kid, as we started the conversation, kid from Brooklyn, you know, who went to night school, who didn't go to Stanford, has no business being in venture capital to be able to invest in 100 companies a year and to do these podcasts every day, to me is a dream come true. And I pinch myself every day and I'm just trying to squeeze every drop out of this amazing orange, you know, that fell in my lap, if I'm being honest.
Well, listen, I guess I didn't realize that starting or doing podcasts were possible. And I did no advertising, certainly the style of it originally. But like I've turned down all advertising on it because it's like, I have my own business that pays pretty well. I don't know if you all have heard about this, but venture capital is a pretty good business on its own. And so
it works out. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good.
Has it increased your deal flow actually? Have you?
Yeah. Well, I can't point demonstrably to like, hey, this deal came because of it. My response rate, I joked that like when I got in the industry 2013, 2014, to like 2021, my response rate on emails stayed constant because while I got more senior, the industry got more competitive, right? And so like there was just more competition to break through the noise. And since I started doing this, the response rate is demonstrably higher than it is before. And the access is just much higher. And people implicitly associate you with the people that they see you talking to, even in small part, right? And so I'm sure after I have this conversation, someone will be like, oh, can you send this to, you know, Jason on XYZ thing? And I think it just elevates the stature or the perceived stature of me as kind of a white liberal arts school business major career finance person. Like I now am something that's like a little more familiar to people than that. And so I don't know. I think it has, but it's hard to say like this deal wouldn't have happened without it. Right.
Well, you know, there's a big difference in the industry when you move from having to fight to get into deals to deals that are oversubscribed, fighting to get you into the deal.
Yes.
Because they perceive some value in it. And I think when you get to year two or three of this, and you're very good at it, by the way, I listen to most episodes.
Thank you.
And getting better, actually, I could see you getting better. And I told you, like, it really is about consistency. If you can do 100 episodes, like you'll all of a sudden be like, okay, I feel like I can just do this. Like playing basketball, playing poker, it just becomes second nature. Yeah.
It's a fucking slog, man. I will tell you, it is getting through. I said originally we were going to do a month, then 3 months, then 6 months, then now I'm at 12 months. And I think I'm at the point of just plowing ahead now. But it's been fun, and it's been even getting episodes out every week, getting people to talk to every week, you know, all this stuff, just the anxiety around getting something out there it's definitely added stress to my life, but it's been fun. I've obviously enjoyed it quite a bit and learned a lot from it. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I thank you and all the other guys for showing that, you know, white men that are business oriented finance people actually can have podcasts, after all, who would have thought?
Well, it's been great to be here. Hopefully, I'll come on next year again when you hit your 100th episode.
And, listen, I think there's some text messages we need to talk about at some point. So you said we would do it.
Yes, just not right now. Just give me a couple of weeks on that one.
Well, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, a couple of weeks, yeah. Maybe. Couple
Last
weeks.
One, Knicks this year, Jason. What do we do? Playoff?
Knicks, 43 wins. We're going to sneak into the playoffs. Yeah, but look for a major trade sometime before the trade deadline.
Brunson looks good. Go Knicks. See you, Jason.
My pleasure. Thanks, Logan.
All All right, so that will do it for the 39th episode of Cartoon Avatars. Thank you to Jason Calacanis, as well as Rashad and Justin and the whole team that works on this at Cartoon Avatars. Next week, we have a guest that I have long admired, long wanted to have on. This has been on my list since I started doing this, someone that I really look up to, and it's a really good conversation. So trust you'll enjoy it, and I look forward to seeing everyone next week. Have a good weekend, everyone.